Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Mike Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And I think we may have been educational in part one. I don't know if we were very entertaining or not.
We're going to spice it up.
Well, this part is on family therapy. The first part was on family. So if you've missed the first part, go back and listen to it. As a general introduction just to a lot of ideas. Maybe it sparks some ideas for you as the listener. But I wanted to tell a story at the top of this. When I first became a therapist, I was very influenced by family therapy. And I liked the way
were you in family therapy?
No. I was not in any therapy at that point. But I was interested in therapy. I wanted to be a therapist, and I liked the way the family therapist wrote about the human condition. It just seemed a lot more affirming. It was not focused on pathology. It was more along the lines of systemic thinking and that kind of thing, systems thinking. And so that's what I really focused on.
Maybe more practical, too.
More practical. Some of it problem solving. But when I started to do therapy, I was terrible at it. I was just not good. I could do individual okay, but family therapy, you really have to be like a combination matador traffic cop. You know, you have to be.
Well, there's a licensed LMFT, right?
Marriage and
family therapist. So it's a specific training modality.
Yeah, that came about after I'd already gotten MSW. Yeah. But I was still doing it. And I heard about a different level of training that was occurring in Ann Arbor with family therapy associates. And so Bennett Wolper and Zona Shiner ran that company. And they were bringing in an expert. The medical director from the Philadelphia Child Guidance Clinic was coming in and doing live supervision with therapists, like a room full of therapists.
Oh, wow.
And there was another room full of therapists that were watching that.
Oh, my God.
So I went for 1 year and I sat in the audience room. There were like almost 20 of us in that room watching these people do family therapy one weekend out of the month for a period of 8 months out of the year. So that was pretty intensive. But the next year I said, okay, I want to be in that room. I want to be in the room where I'm getting live supervision. And there were a dozen therapists in that room. And so we alternated every weekend. There would be six of us that would be doing it. So basically every other month. So you ended up presenting about four different times. You brought families in. It got videotaped. I still have
the
videotapes.
Who are the families? Are these like...
They're families that were in your own...
You would bring the clients with you?
Yeah. And the pitch was... You know, I'm working with you. I think here's a chance to see someone who's a national expert. And I'll be getting some consulting for myself and it'll aid my own training. But you'll also get the advantage of seeing someone who is like kind of at the top of the game. So
was it helpful? I'm thinking it was.
It was way helpful.
Yeah.
It was so helpful. And I felt after doing that, and I did a third year too. After that, I felt like I'm a competent therapist. I feel like I know what I'm doing now. And it was a way of being with people, and it was also a way of conceptualizing people. And the model that he worked with, Charles Fishman was the guy who did this, and he co-wrote a book. Do you know the name Salvador Minuchin? He was a South American guy. He was very, very influential in the whole family therapy business. But structural family therapy was the idea that... it's the structure of the family itself that you work with. You affirm the individual, but you challenge the system. And the idea, the kind of systems that there was an enmeshed system where there's like no boundaries inside the family. Like everyone's merged. Like there's, you know, there's no difference between the parents and the kids.
That was not my family.
Yeah.
We were very differentiated.
Yeah, very. And that's the challenge, is to help people differentiate and to have their own voices and to.
We
have
could have
their
probably
own,
meshed more. We needed more mesh.
The opposite of that is the disengaged family.
Oh, okay.
So the disengaged family is a family where they're basically kind of strangers to each other. That there is not a lot of connection. There's not a lot of engagement. And that's the challenge with that. You know, have you guys thought about having a dinner together a couple times a week, for instance? Or do you have a game night? What would that be like if you had a game night? Let's play a game here together. You know, so that they would have a different experience of each other. And that would be true. So, for instance, like you have a depressed parent, for instance, and who's really disengaged, to pull them in, and that would be a way to engage them. But there were also families that where there was a fair amount of addiction. There was chaotic families.
That is, yeah.
And then there was also abusive families. So those were the main kinds of family issues that we would see. And
what's a chaotic family like? I mean, is that the addiction? And
it could be addiction.
Kind of a subset?
It could be addiction. It could be psychosis. Mm. It could be someone who's just acting out a lot. And it could be violence. It could be, and it could be a chaotic out of the family's own poverty, for instance, or circumstances that was beyond their control. So
arrest, some sort of legal situation.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I first got into the field, I was doing a lot of family therapy. I was back in the 80s and into the early 90s. In fact, I was told by the head of one of the HMOs, they said, you're seeing 80% of the families in this community.
Wow.
And it was really, it was interesting work. It was also hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And
I picture it being so hard.
Yeah.
So hard. I mean, you're not just working with one person. You're working with, like, I mean, how big would you see? Five people at a time? Six, two,
five,
four?
All of those.
Yeah.
So sometimes it might be a single parent with a single child, for instance. But the idea was to have everybody in the family in the room at the same time.
And what about, like, mediating between, like, how would this session go? Would it be on a certain topic, or would you lead it, or would it be like, what do you guys want to talk about today? Or I'm sure it's different based on.
It would be a check-in with every member of the family.
Okay, so
every family member has a voice. You know, what's going on for you? What's going on for you? What's going on for you? How can I help you today? So
we went to family therapy. So
is great. All right, okay, let's get down to it.
my father's a psychiatrist. So so he was exposed. I think it takes a certain family to do family therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, because you kind of have to have everybody on board, mom, dad, or however many people are in the family. I was probably 10, like 11, something like that. And so it was my mom and my dad who had been, I think, in couples therapy on and off for however long. And so I remember there's a male and a female, like therapists. There were two therapists. So one was a woman, one was a man.
Was this in this area?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember where it was.
Was I one of them?
Maybe you were. Oh, my gosh. I'll have to ask my mom if she can remember who these people were.
Yeah.
So it was awkward. You know, I remember that. It's very awkward.
Sure.
So, you know, everybody's sitting and kind of looking at each other. And it's just a very different setting or environment than, you know, you're in normally as a family. And I have a half brother who is my dad's child from a previous marriage, who's like 11 years older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just layers of our family story that, you know, kind of bubble and seethe, and sometimes there's conflict. But I remember my brother being there, and he's very stoic. He is not touchy feely. He does not want to talk about his feelings.
This is
my oldest brother.
Right. Okay.
So it was just like he was like deterred. I just remember seeing his face. He was like not going to participate. And then he did at some point, he became very emotional. Like, you scratch the surface and he was, you know, there was a lot there. It was just very, it wasn't helpful for me, I would say. I mean, other than, you know, our family was committed to trying to work on stuff, you know, that I think in retrospect was a really positive thing. I remember there was another incident. So we had this dog. We always had dogs. My dad was a hunter, so he had hunting dogs that he never trained, so they would end up being these crazy dogs. But one of them was a German Shorthair Pointer, and I was in charge of walking him. And one day he got away from me and he got hit by a car and he died. Ooh. And I was both okay with it because he was a crazy dog and I hated taking him out. I love dogs. I would, you know, never. This was a very, you know, Freud, like an id type of thing. But I was also felt very guilty and horrible and awful and felt like everybody, you know, blamed me. And that came up and I just was like, just all this, I like cried so hard and, you know, and I think everybody, you know, because I.
Did they reassure you?
No, I don't remember that. Maybe. I don't remember that. Yeah. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I, you know, my parents had a lot of issues. I mean, they ended up separating and becoming divorced. So a lot of it was their stuff that was like, you know, affecting the larger family dynamic. And so it was like stuff that I already knew or didn't really have a lot to do with me. And, you know, I was gay and I don't remember if I wasn't out at that point. So I wasn't really interested in divulging all of my secrets and, you know, kind of. Yeah, so it was just awkward for me. It was really awkward.
Yeah.
That's what I remember is awkward.
That's interesting. I'm not going to go into the same degree of detail as you did, but our family did, we were involved in a couple of interventions. So, you know, trying to get somebody into treatment.
Was it you?
It was not me. I'm not going to identify. Although it would be totally safe to do it because I don't think no one in my family ever listens to these. So as far as I know, but I would rather not, that's not mine to divulge. But we did have that experience and it was interesting to me because at the time I was doing therapy and the idea of doing an intervention to try to help someone else in the family. Like I said, it was on the one hand, it was interesting to me. Ultimately, I was going to say ultimately it didn't work. I think it worked to the extent of like, you know, when you're trying to help someone in your family and you feel like, okay, now I've done everything I know how to do. I feel like I can let go of this now. I don't have to push it anymore. This is just going to be the way it is.
That's so interesting because I don't see myself as the one to help people in my family. I mean, in certain ways, yes. Like, I take my mom to the hospital or to doctor's appointments. I like to be involved. You know, I'm a nurse. I like to sort of keep tabs on that. But like if somebody needs, you know, like some type of professional service, like I just don't conceive of, I just don't think that I would be helpful for them. You know, I just don't. In my, like, the way that I see our family is like, you need help from outside this family. Like, you need somebody else.
Yeah. Well, that's true. A lot of times you really have to. I think I'm identified as the helper in my family. Mm. So I think I've mentioned to you, like, I do a family Zoom meeting every week.
Yeah.
Once a
what
week
you were talking about it.
With my sisters who are 8 and 10 years older than I am. So they're elderly. I'm old, but they're elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And
do they like it when you call them elderly?
Yeah, they love it. Well, they talk about it all the time. That's mainly what they talk about. And what's interesting, one thing that shifted for me is that we used to do this thing. It was kind of corny, but we did roses and thorns. So we would be talking about like, okay, what happened this week that was bad? What did you like about this week? And then I realized, like, Jesus, I'm doing therapy with my siblings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so now it's funny because my daughter gave me a present that was called Grandpa Tell Us Your Memories. And it's like every day of the year, there's a question about, do you remember raking leaves? Tell us a memory about that.
Oh, wow.
Do you remember what did you dress up for in Halloween? You know, all those kinds of things. And so now that's what we do. I ask them those questions and they love it. And it's really, you know, it's really a kind of a normal kind of like, let's not dig into your issues. Let's just talk
more
about memories.
Mm-hmm.
What we have in common is our childhoods. And so that's what we talk about and it goes a lot better.
Hmm.
And I'm not doing the codependent. Let me treat you.
Well, I was thinking like in COVID, you know, I did you start doing the Zoom during COVID?
Yes.
Cause we were all disconnected and we did something similar just once or twice cause we're so inconsistent. But, but yeah, I think a lot of people did that. Well, I mean, during COVID, we were all around our primary people lot. So
if I don't do it, they will ask me to do it. They'll text me on Sunday mornings. Are we doing Zoom today? What time? What kind? What time can we do Zoom?
That's
and it's
nice.
Like, it's like, ah, It's an hour out of a Sunday. It's all right. And it is a way to stay connected to him, especially these days.
Yeah. So I have, I guess, been trying to, set up some traditions like that, you know? So I have three brothers, and my dad is dead. He died. And my mom is still alive. So all three of my brothers have kids. So we were also a military family growing up, so we moved around a lot. And my mom is from, like, a military family, so that's kind of a little bit different. I mean, you're so mobile that you don't really connect with, well, you just are not in any place for long. And frequently, you're very far away from your own family. So I didn't meet my dad's parents until I was well into elementary school. Like, I just didn't even meet them until I was probably like second grade is when I met them. At least I remember meeting them. My aunt died. This is my mom's sister. And part of what we talked about in her funeral and memorial and things was how important family traditions were to her, because she grew up in military where there was none of that. Mm-hmm. So she didn't want to be in the military. She didn't want to marry somebody in the military. She was very interested in establishing traditions. And that really struck me, because we have some things, but so anyway, I'm trying to think of ways to connect and create that kind of foundational stuff with with my brother's kids, because the kids love that sort of, you know, anything. They want to look at photo albums. They want to hear stories. Well, they want to know they want to know that.
Do you remember that as a kid? If your parents got together with people that you would be like an agent that would be sitting on the outside listening intently, like what are they talking about now? Especially listening for, like, if they started talking about you, it's like,
absolutely. And photo albums at that point, it was like you would get out this, and my mom's mom made these really amazing photo albums. And so it would just look at pictures of my parents when they got married, and us when we were living in Hawaii, we lived in Germany, you know, these memories that are part of the family memory. Like, I don't remember living in Germany, but I know the pictures, and I know the stories and things.
Well, being involved in your own family's drama as opposed to their trauma, because you're going to be involved in both, but the drama of what brought them there, you know, I think, you know, when I went to Ireland a few years ago and had an understanding, not just of where my family came from, but the ship they came over on, and was able to stand on that dock in Dublin where they left. And I knew that my great-great-great-grandfather and grandmother left as teenagers from different parts of Ireland. They didn't know each other before they got on that ship, and they came over to America. And just to think about those kids who, in the 1850s, as a result of the potato blight, were starving to death and had to go to a whole different country. And just the idea of that. I mean, that to me, it was like one of the most spiritual moments of my life, standing at that dock and looking down the river and saying, thank you. Thank you for all the hardships you endured. We made it. We're here. I'm back. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, just, we all come from some kind of a tradition of survivors. that everybody to get us here, when you think about the odds of you as a specific individual, the odds of you being here are so infinitesimally tiny, and yet here we are. So a lot of things had to happen. But anyway, so
when you're doing family therapy, what are the goals? I mean, is there kind of like a general outcome goal?
It's their goal. And for one thing, I rarely do family therapy anymore. And part of it is just by personal choice. I feel like I did that for a long time. And these days, it's rare that people come and say, I want family therapy. Usually they want an individual thing to happen for them. I think the perspective shifted a little bit. The idea of existing in a community has shifted more to individual, a kind of an individual dynamic and an individual narrative of, like, my issues are my own. You know, they don't belong to the bigger. But when I did family therapy a lot, it was like, what do you guys want to see happen? And the main thing I wanted to have happen is for them to have a different experience of each other inside the context of their family. So when you described, like, okay, my older brother was very stoic, and then we saw him vulnerable, and we saw him crying.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a different experience. You were keeping things inside. you were crying. Mm-hmm. They got a chance to extend comfort to you. You weren't shamed about that. But
you wanted to see the human drama?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
You a voyeur?
Sometimes,
is that the right one?
sometimes it's very emotive. Sometimes it was pretty. It could be dramatic. Sometimes it was kind of mundane. So I mean, it wasn't always psychodrama. There were weird things, like, you know how they do the empty chair, you know, talk to your dad as if he's in this chair. Like, talk to your dad, he's in the chair. he's really right there. Go ahead and do that. And also, you could do something without words. It was called family sculpting. Everybody in the family stand up, get in a circle. Okay, I want you to say, you just said it feels like your dad is pushing you down. Can you arrange yourselves in a way that your dad is pushing you down? Is that what it feels like? And sometimes just enacting it like that, like human statues, like no words, just make it happen. Mm. Something would emerge out of that. There's another example I've got. When I used to do a lot of trainings, you could get people in a big circle and get them to reach into the middle of the circle and take two hands, but they couldn't be the same person's hands. They had to be two different hands, and they had to cross hands. So basically what you had was a human knot. And there would be two big groups of people that were doing that. And one group of people say, figure it out, talk it out, decide how you're going to get unwound. You guys don't talk, just do it. The group that had to talk was like, you know, oh, you got to go under. No, I'm doing this. The group that didn't talk, they just flowed. Hmm. They did it automatically. Hmm. It happened organically. It was kind of miraculous to watch it, because they would do, you know, they'd be done in 10 seconds.
And the other group would be arguing about it. Probably.
Through the Tower of Babel, just everyone yelling like, no, do it this way. Don't do it that way.
I think a lot of times what happens in my practice is, you know, I don't see families, because I am, doing medication management. But with kids, you know, I mean, the parents have to consent to everything. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times with kids, you end up having the parents in there, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the parents show up, and then maybe somebody else shows up, and, you know, it's hard. It's different. I mean, it's definitely different.
Definitely different.
And a lot of times I find, and I'm not a family therapist, so I make that very clear, but people have things that they want to say in a structured environment. But a lot of times people will like talk to me, basically saying things that they would want to say to another person that's in the room. Mm-hmm. Like somehow just being in that environment is more comfortable for them. It's interesting. I'm thinking about, you know, a family. I'm seeing the daughter. She's 15. And so I usually see her with her mom. And then her dad came, and totally different family relationship, obviously, you know, lots more of tension, conflict between the two. And the mom was very much a mediator, and it was just a very different vantage point, different perspective, different dynamic in the room. And it was definitely instructive. And, you know, part of me is thinking, like, I'm not a family therapist. But, you know, I am committed to, you know, my clients. So if this is helpful, but I'm thinking we should have booked
we're going to wrap up in a minute here. But, yeah, certain things that happen with families that I would try to reinforce. One is creating a hierarchy in the family if there wasn't a hierarchy. Mm. This happened a lot with oppositional defiant kids who were acting out a lot.
That was what they called me.
Yeah, I'd ask the family, like, who's in charge? And the kid would say, I am. You know, he's 12 years old. He'd say, I'm in charge. And, you know, for instance, you know,
I would have said, that asshole is.
How do we get the parents back in charge? Establishing boundaries that worked and also having boundaries that were loose enough that people could leave the family if they needed to and come back to the family. You know, those are kind of examples. Anyway, yeah, we could talk a lot more about this, but we're not going to. Hey, we got a surprise for our listeners.
What is it?
Our next episode will include Melissa.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have
a third M,
Mike, Melissa, and Morgan.
Yeah, you're still putting yourself at the end.
Well, I should be at the beginning, but, you know.
A Psycho Delicious Conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is apsychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited.